Welcome to the Today Show. I'm your host, James Lee.
And I'm Danny Love. Today's guest is a true warrior, leader, and trailblazer, a man who has pushed the limits of human potential in mind, body, and spirit. Mark Divine is a retired U.S. Navy SEALs commander who graduated number one in his class, the Honor Man, from BUDS Class 170, one of the toughest military training programs on the planet. He went on to serve for 20 years, including 9 years on active duty and 11 years as a reserve SEAL, leading elite teams on high-stakes special operations missions around the world. After his military career, Mark turned his focus to building leaders and forging resilient teams. He is the founder of SEALIFT and Unbeatable Mind, where he has coached thousands of top performers, including high-profile figures like David Goggins and executives at companies like Google, teaching them the mental toughness, emotional mastery, and spiritual strength needed to thrive in the world's high-pressure environments. He's also a best-selling author with powerful books, including The Way of the SEAL, Unbeatable Mind, Staring Down the Wolf, and 8 Weeks to SEAL Fit. And he continues to inspire millions through his podcasts, keynotes, and leadership programs. And if that wasn't enough, Mark and his team even hold the Guinness World Record title for most burpees completed in 24 hours, 35,393. This is also why I'm wearing my hair slicked back for the first time ever on this show, because right, we're going to do a burpees challenge after this. Mark, thank you so much for being here with
us. Super stoked to be here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yes.
By the way, SEAL Fit.
You know, it's funny. You are in good company, because I was introduced at a Tony Robbins event as the founder of SEALIFT.
Oh, I did.
And I'm like, actually, SEALIFT is like a multi-billion dollar.
SEALFIT. I read it wrong. Normally, I don't have to read anything.
I'm not trying to correct you. I thought it was pretty funny. I was honored.
No, and like you said, Tony Robbins, not bad. But normally, I don't have to read anything. But your accolades are so long, I didn't want to miss anything.
That's so awesome.
Incredible to have you with us.
Yeah, we definitely want to get into all of the stuff that you talk about in your book and your recent one called Uncommon. But first, just because the news is going so crazy and everybody just wants to know from an expert like yourself, you know, with Navy SEAL training, what, LJ, can you pull this clip up? Because what we want is, one of the big questions that we want to try to figure out is like around this Charlie Kirk shooting. And the big question that a lot of people have is like, what's the actual difficulty of this shot? Can a regular recreational
hunter do
this shot or not? And so we're going to play this quick clip. This is what they tell us happened. This is according to the authorities. This is sort of the 3D mock-up of it. And I just want you to take a look, react. I don't know if you've seen this before, and then just kind of give us your expert response here.
At around 12:22 to 12:23 p.m., the assassination occurred suddenly, when a sharp gunshot rang out across the university courtyard. While speaking to the crowd, Charlie Kirk was struck in the neck. Blood quickly appeared as he instinctively clutched his wound and collapsed from his chair. Investigations confirmed the bullet was fired from roughly 200 yards away. Given the elevation of the shooter's position, he had a clear and unobstructed line of sight to the stage where Kirk was addressing the audience. The bullet's trajectory descended steeply and precisely through open space to strike Kirk in the neck, strongly indicating the use of a scoped firearm designed for long-range accuracy.
Okay, so this is the diagram. You can leave this up, LJ, but basically Kirk was sitting here, and what we've been told is that he's sitting at the corner, or the shooter's at the corner of that building. So I guess, how difficult, if you saw that, how difficult is this shot? They tell us it's 200 yards away, descending angle.
Very difficult. From my perspective, and I can tell you right here that I probably wouldn't be able to make that shot.
You know, right now, at the height of your training.
No, right now. I mean, not all SEALs are snipers.
Okay.
Right. In fact, only a small percentage of SEALs are snipers, and sniper training is very specialized. Right. There's a lot that goes into it. Honestly, like if you said, "Hey, Mark, you're going to go shoot this guy," like I would have to go back and do some serious research and literally spend countless hours with the right weapon, right, under tutelage on how to shoot, you know, what the windage is, how to control my breath, and you know, there's a lot involved. You might be surprised to hear that, like a Navy SEAL commander saying, I wouldn't be able to make that shot.
Yeah, because there's so much information online, and so many people are saying a hunter can easily make this shot. You don't need to have any professional training. If you've grown up hunting deer, easy.
You know, I'm not going to poke holes in that, because, you know, there are some hunters who are great
course.
They would make great snipers, right?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other factors involved, like, you know, knowing where to place yourself, right? So a hunter, you know, could walk into the crowd and walk up and pull out a gun and shoot Charlie, and it's just a lucky shot.
Right.
Right, because some people
this
are saying...
This doesn't look like a lucky shot.
Right, this, yeah. Some people saying that this is a professional hit, right? There's a lot of people saying that, and then there's a lot of other people saying, yes, this was somewhat of a difficult shot, but a recreational hunter could do this if they had the training, if they're, you know, practicing, they could pull the shot off. And some people are kind of making the analogy of the sports analogies. Like, a lot of people can go out and kick a field goal, no problem. But if you're talking about, for example, kicking a field goal in a game, linebackers coming at you, then the scenario is a little bit different. Because I, from what I understand, I'm not a hunter or I'm not that familiar with guns, but like breathing is very important in terms of like being calm during the shot to make sure that you're aimed correctly. And then that, you know, you're not distracted by everything that's going on. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, generally speaking, sniping is a two-person job.
I was going to say, yeah.
Right. You have the spotter and then you have the sniper. And the spotter is the one who's basically kind of getting the lay of the land, checking the windage, you know, elevation, any other things that could come in, you know, in between and giving a signal. Okay, this is good. This is your window. To do it alone, like, I've always been highly skeptical of kind of the lone shooter storyline. Mm-hmm. That narrative just so falls apart when you start to really understand what's involved in these things. So it's highly unlikely, in my opinion, that this guy was acting alone. He had training. There were other people involved. There were other people who knew what was happening. I mean, even FBI Director Kash Patel is starting to say that. Like, we have indicators.
Right. It started
that there's
off,
others involved and yes. Other people knew this was happening. And so I don't think it's just a bunch of kids, you know, sitting around, right, the coop saying, yay, you know, he's going to go get Charlie today. No, there's something more insidious going on here.
For sure.
So, yeah, I mean, I think as my assessment as a SEAL commander is if he was a lone gunman, which is extremely unlikely, then he had one hell of a lucky shot, probably less than 5% chance of it happening, right? It's much more likely that he was acting in concert, he had paid supporters, there was training involved, right?
Well, there was also a couple of patsies. I don't know how closely patsies. You're following this story.
Well,
but
I did see something on social media again. I don't know what to believe on social media anymore, except for your channel on TikTok.
I don't know about that. I'm just going to put a disclaimer for some stuff.
I saw images of two kind of like burly looking dudes. It looked like they were making
hand signals,
right?
Right.
Which you don't find, right? And then they said there were a couple decoys in the audience, which would be to slow down the response.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a professional hit, right? Why would anybody need to be making hand signals at a Charlie Kirk conversation?
Right.
Right? To somebody 100%. Else. It doesn't make any sense.
I said on our last episode that we did about it the morning after, when I saw those hand signals, I said, I used to play softball. It looked like the third base coach,
right?
Telling me if I'm going to steal, swipe, exactly. Eat your hat. I'm like, you totally. Know, just it, yeah. It's out of the ordinary.
Totally out of the ordinary.
That somebody would be doing that. And then another thing with this, you know, situation is the rifle. And I think James knows more about that. Just them saying, oh, he took it apart and then he put it back together and how difficult that would be.
Yeah.
James,
so it's a model. I'm not familiar with this rifle, but I don't know if you are. The Mauser Model 98. It's a 30-06 caliber, but they're saying, or the people who know guns are saying, hey, you can't so easily assemble, disassemble and reassemble the gun without affecting the zero of the gun, making sure the scope is aligned accurately. It would be very challenging to do that. Cause the issue right now, I think with the feds is that they can't find a single photo of him on campus with the gun. Mm. He's wearing a backpack. So what they're telling us is that he took apart the gun, put it in his backpack.
Or the gun was pre-staged, which is possible.
And that would probably be most likely.
Right. Most likely.
For a high pressure situation.
Right.
But then no, there's also a video of him walking to the event with the gun in his pants.
Well, no,
saying,
that hasn't, they're claiming that. And
they're claiming
haven't actually
said
that.
Yeah, TMZ is putting that out, saying, hey, he's walking around. He looks like he has a rifle in his pants because he's walking out with a limp.
It's a lot of misinformation.
So I don't know.
It's going to be hard to sort it out. Like even this idea that he would inscribe things on
casing,
the bullet.
Yeah.
On the casing and the bullet, kind of point toward Antifa and these other things. I'm like, I mean, that sounds like deliberate misinformation to me.
Mm.
I agree. And after what we went through during COVID, where freedom of speech, in my opinion, was attacked.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? People were being taken offline, doctors, if
beyond
they were saying—
Beyond opinion, that's a fact.
Yeah, now it is a fact, that's right? A fact. Even Mark Zuckerberg has now come out with this new administration and said that the Biden administration and the agencies were pressuring them to take information off. And that was, you know, Facebook, Meta, Amazon, Twitter at the time. And so now people have been fighting for freedom of speech the last 5 years. And Charlie Kirk was really a leader in freedom of speech. He was going out there, even if he disagreed with people's opinions, he was saying, anybody come talk to me. And since it was kind of like a public execution, it feels like this was kind of a—
it's a way to scare people back into silence.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Well, Pam Bondi's
because
already out there
not
saying
safe,
stuff.
Right? It used to be, okay, you're going to get deplatformed or canceled.
Right.
Now, you might get shot.
Right.
That's really dangerous escalation. Like, it's like unbelievably sad what happened to Charlie and for his family and all his followers. Completely unjustifiable.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that there's people out there that justify this and celebrate it, like, this is new territory. It's very dangerous.
I agree.
What's happening right now.
Because whether you agree with them or not, what happened to Charlie—
the sanctity of life prevails.
Right.
Right? That should be number one, regardless of who you are. If you don't believe in, what they say, you don't believe in their political views, it doesn't mean you have the right to think ill of them or to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but should those people be arrested? Because now they're calling for those people who are celebrating his death to be arrested, which I don't—
that's a slippery slope, too, because that's like—
I don't agree with that.
That's Minority Report. You know, we're going to throw you in jail for your thoughts. But again, there are laws about, inciting violence and putting it out there that you're going to kill somebody, right? You can't state that you're going to go assassinate a public figure or anyone for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so how much is celebrating Charlie Kirk's death and saying, you're next, Elon, right?
That sounds
like you just crossed the line into
threat.
Right,
but if you're saying, hey, the world is better off without Charlie Kirk—
yeah, that's freedom of speech.
That's somebody's opinion, which I don't agree with necessarily, but—
yeah, I remember the only social media X.
That's the one that you use?
It's the only one I use because I'm fascinated with Elon Musk. He's just such an interesting character. I don't agree with everything he says or does, but as an entrepreneur, like, he is very unique.
For sure.
One of a kind. And he put it out there and he said, hey, should X deplatform all these loonies who are celebrating the death? And almost everyone who responded, including myself, was no.
Mm-hmm.
This is why you took over X, to have freedom of speech, protect freedom of speech, to be a town hall, to let the crazy say crazy things, and right, let the whole of it be out there. And he agreed. So
yeah, and I agree as well, because even though I vehemently disagree with these crazy people, I'm just going to call them evil. Because I don't think left versus right
it's
anymore,
not,
right?
No.
This is a good versus evil situation. And that's just what it is. But I would be hypocritical if I said, take them offline, because I was against that during COVID when I felt that some of the information I wanted was being taken offline.
Right.
So unless somebody's inciting violence. But I also, you do a lot of work in leadership. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious what you think about this, because there are a lot of leaders like Elon Musk and others that are continuing with this rhetoric of fight. And I find that to be dangerous with that type of power, because it almost feels like they're trying to incite civil unrest and civil violence. And as much as I love Elon and think that he's a business genius, I think we both know he's not going to be out there on the front lines of the civil war.
Not likely. No,
so,
I agree with
you.
Couple thoughts. First of all, when an ideology, regardless of what you call it, believes that the ends justify the means, and some of those means include assassination or murder or, purging entire populations like happened in communist Russia and China, right? Mm-hmm. Hundreds of millions of people, right? That's where the extreme progressive left has ended right now. Mm-hmm. That's where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
It literally is communism wrapped as socialist democracy, right? Where political assassination is just part of the game.
Mm.
So now we're at a really, really dangerous crossroads because the American political system was supposed to be, right, that we're going to talk, you know, we're talk this out. That's why we have Congress and Senate, right? We're going to deal with our differences in the town hall of ideas. And so when you have one side who doesn't want to share ideas, doesn't want to compromise, wants the power and is willing to kill to get it, now you're at a place where they also lie to obscure the truth. And so it's like the absolute projection, like, you know, this from the psychological thing. You project onto others what you actually say or think or believe to yourself. Mm-hmm. So let me take this to, like, everyone thinks who watches mainstream media that J6 was an insurrection. Mm-hmm. There's nothing there that looks like an insurrection to me.
Right.
In fact, the whole thing looks like a setup, right? You had this peaceful crowd, which was seated with a bunch of FBI agents and others, right, who are opening the doors, mm-hmm. right, to the Capitol and
handing them pamphlets,
say, come on in. They're like, really? Oh, I guess we're supposed to come in. Parade them in front of all the cameras, right? Not allow the Capitol Police or the National Guard to come in and support some kind of peaceful, make sure nothing gets violent. And you had Antifa and some other agitating to make it look violent. And they got it all on camera. And the whole thing was a setup.
Well, that's what I'm saying. How much of right? this, like, left-right is deliberate to divide
that's
people?
That's right. That's what I'm saying. That was deliberate. That was a total optic show. It was a total freaking show. False flag to create this impression that Trump was an insurrectionist, right? To delegitimize, you know, or to legitimize the fact that the election was pretty much ripped off.
Yeah.
Right? Right? For a lot of reasons. We won't go down that rabbit hole. So when I look at this, you know, so we take out Charlie Kirk, who was just revered by young high school, college students who didn't have really any voice for an alternative to what they were learning from the woke agenda and transgenderism, all this kind of crap. And so here's a breath of fresh air. And there's a growing interest in Bible studies, a growing interest in Christianity. And that has a place, right? It's part of this country.
For sure.
Built upon those ideals. And so now you create this situation where you know you're going to provoke from this silent, quiet majority here this intense visceral reaction to fight back, this desire to fight back, right? And even though Jesus says, turn the other cheek, people aren't trained that way, right? And they're mad, they're pissed. And so if they fight back, then the other side, the left, can claim the moral high ground.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And just a few more of these things, agitate a little more, Trump would have to declare martial law, and then they can say, look, he really is a fascist.
Mm.
Right? And so escalation causes response, escalate, response, and all of a sudden, the responder looks like the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all just shaping the narrative, like in mainstream media, has a lot of power still, even though it's slipping, to shape that narrative.
I have to say, I just want to say, I'm really happy with the response so far.
Yeah.
Because people are going to vigils. They're marching, just using their voices. There's no violence. And people are doing more like vigils and prayer circles.
Right. Right.
And so it feels like people are holding back.
They are.
And that makes me happy. Sorry, I didn't.
Oh, no worries. Yeah, no, what I was going to say is, I think to me, we don't really know for sure why this happened, right? We don't even know all the details behind it. So it's tough to speculate, like, was there a motive involved? I mean, people are going from left, you know, saying he's a radical leftist to some right-wing guy. And, you know, I'm out there saying that potentially he was murdered by a foreign agent and this kind of thing. So I don't want to speculate too much on that. But it seems like all the elite powers, the establishment powers, are using this event to kind of just push their own narrative to further whatever they want. So if you're talking about the surveillance state agenda, the Palantir, Peter Thiels of the world, they're using this to say, hey, we need more monitoring of people. We need to scrape their social media. So then we basically create a situation where we're spying on everybody. Other people are going with gun control, you know. So it seems
police state.
So it seems like everybody's just jumping. And this is where I think the conspiracy world kind of converges with what's just, there's just incentives in place. And sometimes they just kind of all align, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just what I want to put out there. Is like, we don't know for sure what's going on, but it seems like there are nefarious actors that are exploiting this to just further whatever their agenda is.
Right. And if you pan out really, and you said this earlier, Danny, It really is a fight of good versus evil, right? I mean, if you want to characterize it like that.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think we're in a spiritual war.
We're in a spiritual war. You know, I read something amazing. I think it was from Dr. Naomi Wolf or something the other day. It was from her Substack, and she was talking about seeing the, these kind of like rabidly, just erratic people mocking Charlie Kirk on social media, mm-hmm. TikTok, like mocking, right? And she equated it to Jesus casting out the demons from this individual and how they came out in legion. He asked them, "Who are you?" And the man responded, "I am legion," which means I'm 2,000, right? In German, mm-hmm. a legion is 2,000 soldiers. And he cast out the demons. Of course, they ran off a cliff, but they were mocking mm-hmm. him, right?
Yeah.
And so whatever you call evil, but low consciousness people mm-hmm. don't have any respect for themselves. They don't have respect for life. And they certainly don't have respect for people who are celebrating life and living large.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about this last week a little bit.
So that's what we're dealing with, is legions of people
yeah.
who are just living this really low-level existence. And it has nothing to do with intellect, right? Because you can be a PhD head of a department at a school and be an extremely low consciousness human being.
Right.
It has nothing to do with intellect. In fact, our culture props up, narcissists and extremely, dysfunctional people. If you put them in a suit and they smile and they look good.
Yeah.
And give them a degree, which is relatively easy to get. It's all mapped out for you. It's easy to get a master's and a PhD in this country. In fact, you can buy it online.
Or money. I think that's another.
And money too, yeah.
Money is another indicator in our society of someone who is, knowledgeable or has a lot of wisdom, but it may not be the case. And the thing I was going to say, I think we talked about this last week, where I think this event made us really reflect on what is good and evil, because remember we talked about how we would feel if Dr. Fauci, who we both like that much, was killed. And then you're like, I might react a little differently, and that might not be good, right? We have to do a little reflection.
Yeah, I really had
there.
To kind of check myself. My best friend said, well, you might be reacting this way if this happened to Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Yeah.
And I had to be honest with myself. I probably would.
Yeah, no,
I think he's evil.
Same scenario. Like, violence is never the answer.
But then I said, it's good for me to reflect on this. But I wanted to say, I did research on you, and you obviously also do this type of leadership coaching. You are a master with mental toughness. And during college, I believe, or your business program, you found Zen and meditation, correct?
Yeah, it was actually after college when I was in New York working as a CPA.
Okay.
Oh, I was going to talk to you about that. Yeah.
And I think you and James.
Yeah. So we actually, we graduated from the same program, because I looked you up, did some research. I'm also an NYU Stern MBA.
No kidding.
Yeah.
We're done.
Probably maybe just like a few years after you, potentially.
I graduated '89.
Okay, so I was
a few more years.
After. I was. I don't want to say, but the point is, like, I think I was really curious about your journey, because like you were working as a CPA, but then you were also doing the meditation. I was working in management consulting, which is another big thing you do after getting an MBA, and we both left that. And your thing, it seemed like potentially a trigger for you was this meditation. You had a bigger calling. Is that what led you to change careers? Can you talk about that?
100%. So I actually, it was like work study. So I was working for Coopers and Lybrand, now PricewaterhouseCoopers, and participating in this program with other firms and others, a bunch of like Ivy League schools and lower Ivy League. So like 75 of us in this program. It started out as a master's in accounting that we went full-time during the summer while we went into the office on Friday. And then in the fall to spring, we went to school at night and worked full-time during the day. And then the following summer, full-time school, and then we got a master's. So I did that, and then I transferred in the MBA program, got my MBA in finance. So I was going to school full/part-time, working full-time, and because I was a competitive athlete at Colgate, I was a competitive swimmer, rower, triathlete, and I got down to New York and immediately saw just how unhealthy everyone was, and I thought, this contrast, like, I'm not going to be like that.
Yeah. Right?
Like, I feel like I'm going to do this, keep this body as healthy as can be for for the life. And this is way before anyone was thinking about longevity or, lifetime fitness.
Yeah.
So I set up this routine where I would go out for like a 6-mile run in the morning, come back, stretch and whatever. I inserted meditation later. Lunchtime, I would go to a local gym and do like a high intensity workout before we even knew what a HIIT was.
Yeah.
Right? I would just like mark a bunch of like equipment and, you know, like Tasmanian and Devil go around that equipment and just break up a good sweat. Anyways, to make a long story shorter, I had a couple hour window between when Coopers would let me off and I had to be at NYU, which was down at the old World Trade Center. And I looked at that as another training time, like a block of time, instead of just going home and studying and eating. Right? That was training time. So I was going to train three times a day.
Wow.
And that was normal to me, right? Still is, actually.
But so, everybody else at the time probably thought you were crazy.
They
right?
thought I was a little bit nuts. Yeah. That was an outlier for
That's
sure.
That's the appointment you have at 12:30, huh? That you have to get out of. You have a training. No?
I actually have to go to physical recovery.
Oh,
physical,
yeah. I was just joking.
PT, because I trashed my shoulder this spring. That's a whole different story. We'll talk about that later. So I wanted to do something in that two-hour block, and I was pondering what to do when I stumbled across this martial arts studio on 22nd Street. And it's I went up there and I met this guy named Nakamura, and he was a grandmaster, founder of the style of karate. He had like 300,000 students already. This is 1985 around the world. And there was something so different about him. You know, I couldn't quite put my finger on it then. Right? I now know what it is, right? He was an enlightened man, which is a rarity in our world, right? It's rare. He wouldn't go around and say he was enlightened, but I can now identify the qualities, right? Spontaneity, complete lack of ego, totally grounded, centered, fiercely intense, but also utterly light and playful, right? He'd be like, do this, do that. And then suddenly someone would crack a joke and he'd be like giggling like a little schoolgirl.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing guy. So I was like, I want that, right? So he became my first real mentor. Started studying the karate, the hard part. Stayed one night to watch the black belt class on Thursday night. And after the class, turned out all the lights, and someone went over the corner, lit a candle, and about 10 of these black belts, I mean, he had hundreds of students, pull out these little wooden benches and line them up, and they start sitting down. And I'm like, what are they doing? Mind you, this is 1985, and the person at the front desk said, well, they're doing the Zen class. I'm like, Zen? He said, well, get a book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. You'll learn all about it. I read the book, didn't understand a word. Then I asked Mr. Nakamura, I said, can I join that Zen? I'm a white belt. These are all black belts. He said, of course. So that was an inflection point in my life. Mm. I'm 21. I started studying Zen first Thursday nights, but I had such an incredible experience with it that I bought my own little wooden bench and added practice in the morning and the evening to my routine. And I've never stopped.
Wow.
Completely transformed my sense of self, my understanding of the story I was living. It also transformed how my mind worked, right? Mm-hmm. So I started to access information, right? Spiritual information, soul information, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I kept getting this sensation that I was a warrior. Again, I would go into the meditation and I'd go through the Zen practice of clearing my mind and the concentration. And then you would just naturally fall off into like pure silence, non-personal stillness, no identification as Mark whatsoever, but I'm still completely aware. And when I was in that state, it's also a timeless state, right? And you don't experience any separation or any time. Everything just becomes really, really like quiet and thick, almost like it's a solid block of reality and you're just part of it. Hmm. And I would literally come back with a sense of knowingness every time that I was a warrior and that I'm heading down the wrong path fast.
Right. The corporate world is not exactly.
I didn't think I could be a warrior in the corporate. So, because that's clear. I didn't come back from these, you know, these little meditation trips, so to speak, as a, you know, with like, hey, I'm going to be a Navy SEAL. It had nothing to do with doing or a job or a career. It was really about one's essential nature. My essential nature in this incarnation was one as a warrior. And so then I started, that was like the first time I learned that it's important to ask really good questions of yourself and about your life. So I started to ask better questions. And then I started journaling. And so questions such as, if I'm a warrior, can I be a warrior, right, as a merchant? Mm. You know, as a CPA and running a business or, you know, making a lot of money. And I didn't disqualify that idea, but it didn't feel
like your calling.
It didn't feel like my calling. And so then the corollary to that is, if that's not how I'm meant to be a warrior, then how? Right? how am I meant to be a warrior? And this is where kind of this inner sense of beingness meets doingness, and we call that synchronicity, because I was starting to vibrate with that idea, and suddenly the universe like showed me how. Mm-hmm. They're walking home from work, and I walked a path that I hadn't taken before, and I walked past this Navy recruiting office, and there was this poster on the wall. I didn't even know I was at a recruiting office. And the poster, the title was Be Someone Special, and it had Navy SEALs doing cool shit. And it didn't say anything about the SEALs. It was a total bait, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They'd bring in guys like me and send you into the submarine force or something like that. And I just stared at that thing for like 20 minutes. That's it. Mm. That's how I'm supposed to be a warrior.
Wow.
And it took me until I was 25. It took me 2 years to get into the SEALs, because the path from civilian to SEAL as an officer is a very narrow gate. It took 1 to 2 a year.
And that training, once you got in, right, you have to train, and not everybody makes it through. What are the
stats for that?
Yeah.
Less than, 10% or less, I should say, make it. So 90% fail rate. So my class, 170, 185 of us started. 19 graduated. Original people graduated.
Wow.
So
and you were the top.
I was the number one graduate.
And I read that your whole team graduated, right?
Right.
So you had a team of 7. Is that
right,
correct?
Right.
And you started teaching your team the meditation practices
right.
that you had learned.
Right. I attribute that. I mean, yeah, I was physically fit, right?
Yes.
I was a triathlete, competitive swimmer. You know, I had these skills, but that's not what led to that success. It was my ability to maintain mental and emotional control while under extreme stress, number one. And number two is my ability to like really genuinely take my eyes off myself and put them on my teammates, knowing that together, right, we'd be stronger. And together, I'd be stronger. Not just we, but I. It's kind of that law of reciprocity, right? If I'm taking care of 6 others and I really care about their success and I'm going to teach them everything I know, then I've got 6 other people who are really caring about me. And Bud's basic underwater demolition SEAL training is like dog eat dog. And, you know, people are like cheering when guys drop out because it's one less person to compete against.
Wow.
So it's uncommon for that kind of cohesion and collaboration.
Correct.
Usually.
But what I found, and it seems obvious to me now, but it wasn't obvious back then, and it's not obvious to most SEAL students, is the instructors are not looking for the biggest, baddest person. They're looking for the best teammate. Mm. Because, you know, it's a three-year tour. The instructor goes back to SEAL team, whatever, and guess what? Mark is going to be on his team.
Right.
And so number one thing they're looking for is exceptional team ability, which means you can't have a big ego. Right? They'll find a way or make a way for the big egos to like get out.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the first people to usually quit are like star quarterback of such and such football team.
Oh, wow.
Because everything came easy for them. They were used to getting, you know, lorded over.
Yeah.
And they expect preferential treatment. And that doesn't go very well with SEAL instructors who are looking for
the teammate.
Yeah, I
would imagine not.
Right.
You're not good. They might be getting special treatment, but just not in the way they're used to, right?
Right, right.
A lot of attention.
Yeah, so my little team, it was very simple. There's 4 skills. We call them the big 4 skills. I taught them, and I sort of learned these through Nakamura, but just common sense too, right? First one was controlled breathing, right? So I taught them what had worked for me when I was doing Zen. Nakamura said, inhale slowly through your nose, and then exhale slowly. And so I said, well, I like that, but I also like to hold my breath.
Okay.
Because it would steal my mind a little bit. So I would inhale to a 5 count, hold my breath to a 5 count, exhale to a 5 count, hold my breath to a 5 count. This is on the bench in 1985, 86. And I called it box breathing. And so as soon as I got the Buds, and I had, like, it had this incredible effect to calm my body, mind down, to clear my head, and to get me quickly into like an open state of open mind, open-hearted meditative awareness. So I was like, that's money, right? Breath controlling the breath helps me control my emotions and my thoughts. So this is good. We're going to work with this. So I taught them that. Mm-hmm. And then I grew up in a I love my family, of course, but there's some negativity, you know, generations of alcohol and, you know, a little bit of rage going on.
Yeah.
All of it just rich and juicy. But what it led to is like a little self-esteem issues, a little bit of negative programming, you know, and some negative dialoguing. And when I started meditating, that revealed itself to me very clearly. Because in meditation, with dedicated practice, you develop this capacity to like separate from your thoughts, to be able to observe them in real time. Call that witnessing. It happens naturally. It's like this pop. Most people are completely merged with their thoughts and emotions, and they're just living this drama, and they don't realize there's a way out of it, right? Mm-hmm. Drama is inevitable. Being dramatic about it or caring about it is optional. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So once you have that separation, you can choose to engage or not in those thoughts. But I saw that my thoughts were largely negative. You can almost say I was toxically positive back then because I was smart. I looked good. I always had a smile on my face. Maybe toxic positivity isn't right, because toxic positivity is when you're over judging everyone else. I was judging myself. Mm. And so I said, I got to change that. And so I began to override that. And I didn't fight it. I just started talking to myself kindly, right? Starting with like, I like myself.
Yeah.
I'm a good person. I'm worthy. We got this. I can do this. I'm a positive individual. And it sounds corny, but it, you know, over time, by feeding those thoughts, I call it feeding the courage wolf, all that other negative stuff just kind of like went away.
I don't think it sounds silly at all. I think, you know, as you're saying this and us bringing up what happened with Charlie Kirk and just the state of the younger generation right now, I feel like maybe you would be a great teacher to teach them these things, right?
Get them back in control.
Yes, because with maybe it's the screen times or the phone times or whatever it is, it doesn't seem like people are being taught to ground themselves and separate themselves from their emotions, right? Like you were saying, they're almost becoming this, and then they're spiraling in the drama. Would you agree with that?
100%.
Or? Okay.
100%. They're completely merged with the content they're consuming. And they're out of control. And this is why mental health is at a crisis right now across the country. The only thing you can control, I mean, right, is your thoughts. But most people haven't learned that.
And it's really hard for some people.
Right. It's very hard.
You know.
Right. So, I mean, I teach a whole progression. Like, you have to get your body under control because your brain's part of your body. And most people are stuck into hyperarousal, so their brain is like operating at like high beta gamma and just racing thoughts. And then they're feeding it all this negativity, right? And the brain is wired to be 5 times as negative as it's positive.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they're constantly in a negative state, which keeps them trapped, right, in a negative state.
So would you say that might be what these people online perpetuating these videos and these celebrations are kind of in that
And they
state.
Lose their agency. And it makes them really susceptible, right, to auto-suggestion and to manipulation. And,
right.
Right. And so then they, you know, and everyone basically creates their own reality. I mean, this ultimately, we're in a reflective universe, right?
So, like a matrix, do you think?
Yeah, well, that's a good metaphor. The difference is our minds, so in the matrix, your mind was generating the experience.
Okay.
So that part is true. Your mind is generating this experience.
Okay.
Right? You can't. Anybody who does an investigation into that statement will find that it's true, right? So if your mind is full of negativity and fear and hate, then your experience is one of negativity and fear and hate. You attract exactly what you're vibrating at.
It's like what they say, whatever you put back, you
get
back.
Yeah, you get what
you
put out there, right? And so you're seeing a world that's full of hate and violence because you're creating that reality. Mm. And then you just play right into it, right? As a violent person or a hateful person. And then, you know, of course, that's very easy to play the victim and to point and say it's someone else's fault. So that's what happens. So to get your agency back, you got to get your body back under control. And the best way to do that is through controlled breathing, nostril breathing, to activate your
parasympathetic.
No, burpees help. Getting healthy helps.
Yeah.
Getting healthy, physical training really does help.
Yeah.
But physical training and breath kind of go hand in hand.
Right.
But then the breath becomes the link or the bridge between the physical reality and your internal experience of reality. So it becomes a bridge between the body and the mind and then emotions and then spirit. And the test of that is, like, if you are agitated and angry, right, your breath is going to be like through the mouth and very rapid and shallow. But if you literally just stop that, close your mouth, inhale slowly through your nose, 5 count in, hold your breath for a couple, and then exhale slowly through the nose or mouth and literally started calming yourself down, guess what happens? Your emotions start to follow suit and they start to calm down. Same thing with your thoughts. So your thoughts and emotions are inextricably linked to the quality of your breathing. That was the masterful thing that I learned from through my trial and error, and I taught it to my team. Everyone else, like the instructors, like, go hit the serve, do this, do that. And they're freaking out, or, you know.
Yeah.
Right? You're hell week. You know, machine guns are going off overhead and it's like chaos. And everyone in the class is freaking out. And I'm sitting there with my six guys saying, stop, pause, breathe, calm, breathe. We got this. So that was the first skill. And then the second skill, we verbalize. We got this. Piece of cake.
Telling the
positive story that we're going to work our way through this, right? And everyone, like, instructors would be looking at our team like, how come they're not moving? And I was like, because we don't know where to move yet, right? Everyone else is just moving without thinking. We decided to think before we move. But in order to think well, we had to be calm. We had to be positive, or else we're going to come up with the wrong solution or a negative solution.
Yeah, can I ask you a question that's related to, like, how you were helping your team? And also the title of your book, you know, The Uncommon Man?
Just Uncommon.
Just the Uncommon. So what I'm wondering,
like,
is...
You. Uncommon.
It's like, it's uncommon. It's like very, you know, the stuff that you preach is very individualistic, right? It's stuff that you're supposed to do, but then you pass it on to the rest of your team. You kind of played a role in passing that message on. So by definition, though, you know, not everybody can be uncommon, right? Because then everybody, it would just be common again. So
there'd be another level of uncommon.
So what I'm wondering is, you know, how do you stop the common people, right? Which most of us are, from, like, falling trap into this darkness, this evil that we talked about before. Is there some responsibility that the uncommon person has to kind of, you know, protect against that? Which is kind of...
It really depends upon what your calling is, like what you're supposed to be doing, right? So I had the insight, you know, back to, like, this idea that I had this awakening or this understanding that I was meant to be a warrior. That's still there, but it was supplanted by teacher. So I'm both a warrior and a teacher now, both of them archetypal energies. And of course, what I teach is going to be really unique based upon my experiences. And I had some unique experiences with regard to this blending of Navy SEAL and kind of Zen yoga, kind of Eastern, Western psychology. Like, I've had a lot of all those experiences. And for some reason, my brain can assimilate and distill and communicate in a very effective way to a Western audience.
Mm-hmm.
Things that were, for, you know, used to be inaccessible to them. Because I'm wrapped in robes, or, you know, like Sanskrit language, or, you know, Buddhist principles, or, you know, whatever. It wasn't accessible. On that note, you know, when I used to train SEALs, when I started SEAL Fit, not Sea Lift, when I started SEAL Fit, and training Navy SEAL candidates, like I used to have these long 30-day live-in academies, like Shaolin Monk Academy. You can imagine that. Like, we trained from 5 in the morning until like 10, 11 at night, 7 days a week. And our graduation ceremony was 50 hours of nonstop training.
Wow.
No sleep. And that was to simulate Hell Week. And so I had this 8 weeks of SEAL Fit was the physical program that I developed for that. It was hardcore. It got them fit, not just for buzz, but for combat and durable. Like, they were unbreakable. You know, maybe that took a third of the time. And then I'm like, okay, I've got to teach them mental toughness and resiliency. And so that's where I developed Unbeatable Mind, all the principles of Unbeatable Mind. And I drew heavily on sports psychology, Western psychotherapy, yoga, my Zen training, right? Because I'm like, we didn't have any knowledge base around mental toughness and resiliency back in the early 2000s.
You were a pioneer, really, in this
space. Yeah, I was like the OG. And so I drew from those instances. Like, and I remember teaching yoga and breath control, which is called pranayama, right, in the yoga tradition, to these young SEAL candidates, and they were literally just rolling their eyes at me. And even some of them said, well, I can't do this. It's against my religion. And I was like, okay, what's going on here? They said, I see. This is a major, like a cultural clash here. Like they don't get it because it's not their language. And I haven't connected it to the practical application. Mm. So I literally called all stop and I went back to the drawing board and I call it taking the foo out of the kung fu. I took the foo out of the kung fu. And I created a yoga program that was like short drills. It included breath work, visualization, movement, and included even kettlebells and burpees, right? Because the guys wanted to move aggressively.
Yeah.
But also all the asana that they needed to develop their spine, their hip strength, their joints, you know, mobility. And so now, like 20 years later, the SEALs have fully embraced yoga.
Wow. Right?
And they fully embrace box breathing.
So
and
your
visualization.
Methods yeah. now are...
They live on in buds, you know, and they...
Wow.
They recommend my books, Unveil Mind and The Way of the SEAL. That's pretty cool.
Really cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's what's...
I don't
I think
know if
missing
I answered your question.
From
I probably didn't.
Well, I think I was trying to relate it to a larger societal question of you know, we have all these books to teach the individual how to better themselves. Do you have that responsibility then to pass it to others? Because by definition, we can't all be this mindset. So then how do we improve society as a whole?
Your like
individual calling.
Yeah, so you know, I've got clients who are just mothers and they're doing their job by passing it on to their kids. Mm. First, just through their presence and their example. Even if someone just starts with the box breathing practice, right, which I recommend as a morning ritual, evening ritual, 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the evening, it'll change your life.
Okay.
And it develops arousal control, attention control, concentration, mindfulness, and greater presence. And over time, it also opens the heart, so you become more compassionate. Simple practice has all those benefits. And so when people... believe me, right? Because they're like, I believe you because you're Commander Navy SEAL and, you know, you've got Western credentials and it sounds like you know what you're talking about. I'm like, okay, I do, but your study of N=1, if you do this and you commit to it for 3 months, I guarantee you, you will have some significant shifts in your awareness and of these other things that I talked about. And they do. And oftentimes they're like, I didn't even notice it until my kid came up to me and said, Mom, like something's really different about you and I like it. Keep doing it.
Wow.
Right? Or husband or wife says to their husband, and honey, you know, you're really showing up differently. So thank you for the work you're doing. And they feel calmer, the less reactive, right? So that's it. It can be just paying it forward to one person you love or those corporates. We have CEOs come to our training or entrepreneurs, and then they bring these skills back into their company, right? And it takes a little while to get everyone on board. We call that developing a growth culture where the culture is okay to participate in like box breathing. So we do this with our company. We every important meeting, box breathing. Before every coaching session, box breathing.
I love
so
that.
So you bring the skills into these environments, which then shapes the environment to be more compassionate and aware. So no, you know, if you're not a teacher, don't teach. You might add to the confusion in the world.
Right.
But you've got some reason for being here. Your first job is to figure out what that is and to live it. And then to do it with such integrity that your very presence impacts other people positively.
So you're saying that it would be a good idea if Trump would start every address with a little box breathing for everybody. Yeah, right?
Can
that
you
would
imagine
be
that?
Yeah.
Well, he would take up the practice himself, just right. Become less reactive and bombastic or whatever, you know.
And that's one of my I think biggest critiques of Trump is that he uses some of these, you know, opportunities not to unify, but to divide, right? To say, oh, this is the radical left versus, you know, I understand that language is going to be out there, but as a unifier, you want to be, hey, let's breathe, right? Exactly what you're preaching.
Or at least make an attempt to have a national dialogue from a place of calmness instead of just pointing fingers and screaming. I remember I was invited to go train Congress. Not everyone showed up, obviously, but there were about 40 or 50 Congress.
Yeah, tell us who showed up.
Congress people, yeah.
No, you don't need to. Yeah. We already know.
Yeah. It was my friend who's a New York congresswoman who invited me. And I did box breathing with these Congress people, and they loved it. I don't think a single one of them took it on as a practice, right? Because they're so...
So busy.
So busy and so patterned, right? That's the challenge. Like, you really have to break serious patterns in order to add something so unique like this to your wheelhouse. And if you don't have any experience with it, you tend to be a doubter. A lot of people doubt it. They don't know.
Well, because maybe they don't understand the full benefit of it.
They don't understand the full benefit.
Right, because they spend, I've heard recently, 80% of the time fundraising. So they're like, is this going to stop me from making another phone call? If it is, I don't really want to do it unless I can see how this is going to bring me more money or something like that.
Right. Good point.
But in any routine, you can always make time in your schedule.
100%.
In my opinion. You have to be very disciplined. And you have to plan it out. But if something's important, you can fit it in.
100%. Everyone's got a morning ritual, whether they're aware of it or not.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what all I say is like, just replace some things that you're doing already in your morning ritual that aren't effective with something that's going to be transformative. Right. So when you wake up, so morning ritual is so important. We call this time winning in your mind before stepping foot in the battlefield. Right. Mm. So you. Let me back up. You only have today. Today's the only day. Yesterday's, like when we went to the seal grinder, there's a big sign that said the only easy day was yesterday. Why? Because it's just a memory. You can,
it's gone.
You can think about the work you did yesterday, but it's not going to have the pain. It's not going to have the suffering. And it's not going to help you, right? Mm-hmm. It's actually a waste of time. And you can think about what you might do tomorrow, but that's also a waste of time. There's because tomorrow hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
It's just an idea. It's a fantasy.
I was going to say, there's a Chinese proverb that says, if you think about the past, you're going to be depressed. And if you think about the future, you're going to be anxious.
You're going to be stressed. Yeah, anxious. Yeah, that's right.
Kind of what you're saying.
100%.
Right?
And most people live in the past or the future. Living in the past basically contaminates the future or the present with the past energy, which guarantees your future is going to look just like the past. So, so let's just... You get clear. All we have is today. So given that, what are we going to do with it, right? How are we going to optimize today? Well, it would make sense that we start on a solid foundation. So the morning ritual is critical. That's winning in our mind before we step foot in the battlefield. It starts the moment you wake up. And the moment you wake up, right, your mind is going to be filled with dreams, memories, what happened yesterday. Some people grab their phone and it starts filling up. And then it just, all the patterns of yesterday, trained condition, just reactivate. And you're off to the races, basically doing the same shit over and over and expecting different results. So the first thing we want to do, like in this kind of warrior ethos, is to curate the quality of your thoughts from the moment that you wake up. Mm. So we use mantras, that positive dialogue, gratitude, right? Mm. And then from there, we begin to control and train our physiology through the box breathing practice. Arousal control, get everything calm and, you know, that's like weeding the garden. And then we go into a concentration training because concentration basically gathers up your mental energy into a single thought stream, focusing on the box pattern, which trains your attention. We have a big attention control problem.
Yeah.
So this will train your attention.
I'm not sure if we're helping with that.
Yeah.
With the short form that we're producing.
Probably not. This one, though.
A little self-reflection.
So you train your attention by concentrating for maybe 5 minutes or 10 minutes of the practice. And then you're going to go release energy. Mm-hmm. So you stop efforting so much. You're not concentrating. And now you're going to relax and you're going to be just doing some, you know, mindfulness. But what you're looking for is to... open up into what we call the contextual mind as opposed to the content mind. So it's related to like right hemispheric thinking, which is context, and like presence, right? That part of your brain is the one that gets activated when you're really present and you're in this broadest perspective of possible. And the left hemisphere is activated when you're kind of thinking through a problem. It is also what generates this experience of linear time. So we want to open up to contextual mind and just be very present. This is a practice called immediacy, just very present with whatever is right now and develop the capacity to observe it without engaging. I talked about that earlier. And you just keep practicing it until all of a sudden it becomes, like you have this permanent shift where it becomes your natural state.
And these Doesn't are the types to, of... Sorry, go ahead.
You don't have to practice it. It just is the way your brain works.
You just fall into it. It's like becomes a flow of your morning routine. And these are the types of techniques you're teaching Google executives. Right. And is this also what you taught David Goggins, or is that a different relationship? Or
Well, Goggins has a little bit of his own thing going on.
Okay.
And we've had many conversations.
Okay.
I don't know if he's into meditation.
But either way, when you learn
But I teach
about
these to executives and entrepreneurs.
Yes. And it seems like the most successful people in the world, whether you're living in the United States or elsewhere, have some sort of a morning ritual where they practice gratitude, mindfulness before they start the day. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me that with this data out there, we're not implementing that into our school system.
Right.
Why aren't we teaching our kids this? Wouldn't that help solve the problems that we're seeing out there in society today where they feel so disconnected from one another and don't really have a lot of empathy and compassion, which is probably, to me, one of the most important human traits.
Right. I think you find a lot of private schools are doing it.
Oh, really?
A lot of homeschoolers do it. Charter schools will do it. But these are kind of curated groups of people.
Right.
You know, the parents are like, I want my kids to do that.
And they also have to have the money to be able
right.
to
but
do that.
But the big
too.
Public education, I mean, that entire model is completely irrelevant, by the way, for the age of AI. And I don't see any like rush to change it.
Yeah.
But it was built for the industrial age. It was built
to create good workers.
Yeah, to create good workers, not to create free and autonomous spiritual kids.
And now that we are moving into that AI state, maybe we need to revisit.
For sure.
Well, I mean, this is once again going to the lack of, you know, aligned incentives in that I don't know if the government wants free spiritual people who think on their own.
No.
And this,
not,
they
not
want
the people, current structures.
Right. They want people in line. Hey, go to school, get a good job. Don't ask questions. Produce.
Watch your TikToks, watch your Instagrams, and then they can be more easily manipulated.
That's right. Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, if you look at just the price of things over time, what's really interesting is the price of television has gone down. That's one of the few things that has not, it's deflated over time, whereas everything else from healthcare to education,
apples,
everything, food has gone up over time.
With the phone, right? Eventually the phones will be free because they want everybody to be.
Well, basically, it's free.
Glued
it's like,
that.
Oh, you sign up for our plan, you get the free phone, blah,
they
blah,
want
blah.
Everybody to be glued to the media so that they're highly suggestible and they're picking up all the propaganda. We have a saying, if you're not training your mind, someone else is training it for you.
Mm.
And the results will speak for itself, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because James and I, when we linked up, we think differently on certain topics, but I've never let that bother me. I listen and I respect his opinions and he does the same. And we've both talked about how we've, talked to other people in our space where they do get very irritated by your opinion. And I think it's
by just the mere fact that we are sitting together at a table and talking, people are like, why the hell are you doing that?
Well, they drag me, James, I don't know, untouchable over here, but, you know. But yeah, it's just interesting. And I think that comes from a place of being grounded, knowing oneself.
Right.
And I need to take your program because I want to,
what do you do when you get up in the morning? Like, what's the first things you, because not what you're talking about.
I knew Mark was going to be here. So this morning I woke up at 5:30. I got on the treadmill. I ran 2 miles.
That's for you.
I stretched. I made my celery juice. And then I did my matcha. And said a prayer.
That's good.
That was my
morning. Pretty solid.
So
yeah,
but is that every morning? Yeah,
no, not every morning.
Add a little
five
box breathing and meditation to that.
Okay, I do need to do that because sometimes you're just, for me it's a checklist almost. Right. I want to get my workout done. I want to get my celery juice done and these things. And I think that's the big thing. We're always in a rush. Mm-hmm. And we need to make time to slow down a little
right? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I think that's the biggest thing. Think about it. Like we're so biased toward action in our culture, right? It's got to do.
Yeah.
Action is only 50% of the equation. You know, the action has to come from some source of energy, from some, right? It's like, think about the ocean metaphorically, right?
Or even
the waves are just at the surface, but it's the energy beneath the surface that actually will determine the size of the wave and its momentum and its power. So the energy that is within you is we call your potential. And that needs to be nurtured, right? Because otherwise you're just kind of like creating this really choppy surface level stuff. And all those little waves that you're creating in life have very little power. And you tend to do too much. So think about like a really choppy surface. Well, what if you slowed down and you got real clarity around what the right thing to do is, and you develop all this potential, right? Welling up, right? From deep within, and put that out in the world. And you're going to create,
then you're a tsunami.
You create a tsunami, right?
Yeah.
That's like the most truly successful people do less things with way more power. And so when you think about that, like if you think, well, I'm always busy. I'm running around with a chicken in my head. If I'm on this board and that committee and this thing, well, it's because and you're doing way too much. So you're throwing your energy all over the place. You're wasting it. So yang energy is like this action, you know, got to act. And we get rewarded for that in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
But is it powerful action? Is it aligned action? Right? Is it action that's going to lead to second and third order positive benefits as opposed to second and third order negative, you know, consequences? So we'd like to say you need to develop the yin capacity, right? Which is almost non-existent in our culture. And the yin capacity is the ability to like pause, just be utterly still, to just stop. Stop without any expectation, stop without any need to do anything, to sit in silence and to tap into that like deep wellspring of potential that you have. And recovery, you know, comes from that. Spiritual strength comes from that. Intuition comes from that. Mm-hmm. Creativity comes from that. Direct perception or spontaneous knowing, or suddenly you know something without knowing why or how, and you never read it before. That comes from that.
I've had those moments.
For sure. So we all have it. But then my point is that these can be nurtured and brought online. And I think this is like the next frontier for leadership development, is to develop these qualities that really are like the human qualities that are everything that AI can't do.
Right.
Because everything that we do right now, AI will do.
And AI is never going to be able to do what you're
talking
about.
But can't do the creativity, the intuition, the spontaneous motives, the open-hearted connection, the spiritual strength. That's where we need to put our energy.
Well, I think that's such a good message in terms of like do versus the pause. Because I feel like for us, in terms of like what we do for work, I think we always feel the pressure to, hey, I need to put out more content, more posts. But sometimes it's probably good just to like take a pause. And
you don't need to be talking directly to me.
And sit down with your thoughts. I'm looking at you because
it seems like he's trying to tell you something.
He is. He always likes to take a beat and I'm like, breaking news.
I'm saying that's, I think that's important for everybody to say, hey, maybe sometimes we should take a pause and really reflect before we do again. Like
for sure.
with your Navy SEAL example of like, hey, there's everything's
pause,
going on.
Pause, breathe, think, and then act.
So in terms, we have a couple minutes left. So I just want, you know, a lot of this stuff I think is maybe overwhelming for people to listen. It's like, oh, I don't even know where to start. So if you had just one kind of starting point for people who may be intrigued by some of the concepts that you talked about today, what would you say the first step is?
Well, the first step is to pause, right? And so pause can be literally, right, at beginning to notice when you start to spin up, right? When you're anxious, when you're agitated, driving, and you've got a little time pressure because you're running late. Just to pause and slow down and just start breathing, right? Don't judge yourself, right? It's totally normal. Just start breathing. And then let that lead you into a controlled breathing practice. Learn how to slow down your breathing, breathe through your nostrils, 5 count in, 5 count out. That's 6 breaths per minute, but you're using your diaphragm, you're pulling oxygen all the way deep in your lungs. And that breath cycle, 5 count in, 5 count out, naturally will lead to a de-stressing of your body and reactivation of the parasympathetic nervous system, which most people right now is lying dormant because it's been atrophied because everyone's in a state of hyperarousal. So slow and controlled breathing, nostril breathing,
and putting
closed.
Your phone down to do it, right? Don't be watching your TikTok while you're doing your breathing
that's
exercise.
A great one. Do this several times a day and just set that thing aside, right? Take a little sabbatical from your phone and breathe deeply and pause. That's developing kind of this yin capacity, the comfort with being, you know, just not doing anything, just being quiet. And what you'll find is you'll be much calmer. You're going to start gaining some clarity, right? Because your brain gets more comfortable with that stillness. You'll have a more emotional regulation, right? Because thoughts and emotion are, you know, are like cousins, right? They chase each other around. and you're going to start to actually be more positive too, because all those gaps between glued to TikTok versus sitting down and I'm breathing, develop this contrast. And you're like, well, I feel really good. And then as soon as you get back on TikTok, you're like, I don't feel as good right now. Mm. I mean, I can feel it. Even if I scroll X for like 5 minutes, I'm like, okay, stop. Because it's starting to, you know.
Increase anxiety.
I don't, it's yeah. Like, oh, wow. Even with all my yogic skills to like block all that energy, it's very potent.
Yes.
Social media is very potent and negative. Mm-hmm. So you have to be very careful about your use of that.
So where can people follow you on social media to learn about taking a pause? is, no, seriously. I mean, we do want, I mean, like,
my,
I think
my
this
Instagram
has been really
channel is Mark Divine Official. Facebook, Mark Divine Official. And LinkedIn.
YouTube, so sometimes we do have to harness some of these things that are we could perceive as overall negative to achieve a positive.
Well,
out
and the
of it,
thing
right?
Is that like, social media can be negative, but it's also incredibly powerful and positive in so many ways, right? Like with different world events now, because everybody has a phone. Right. Yes, it can make people in a hyper state, but it also spreads the information.
100%.
And it can allow people to rise up and be positive. You have meditation apps now. And you are a great source for what we need in this current time.
Right.
And your knowledge, I mean, you really were a pioneer in bringing the meditation to the Navy SEALs and the box breathing and all of this and mental strength, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that everybody could really learn a lot from the wealth of knowledge that you have, gained over your life. So I'm going to be calling you now and saying, hey, I want you to be my teacher because I want to be better at this.
Sure.
But no, I think that your message is just amazing. And I feel like we could talk to you for hours and hours.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Really appreciate you joining us today. Appreciate the followers of the Today Show, especially the Patreon members for helping us make this happen, for giving us the money to run the operation. We can't say thank you enough.
And for our Patreon members, now, James and I are going to do a burpee challenge for the vets, right? So you have awesome. A burpee challenge for the vets?
We have a program called Burpees for Vets. And every November, we come together, corporations and individuals and gyms like F45 and whatnot. And we do burpees, lots of them, right?
Well, we'll see how many
We raise money for veterans who have post-traumatic stress and suicidal challenges.
I love that.
It's really important.
Well, hopefully we can reconnect with you in November. But for now, I said this before the show, but I'm going to say it again. I told James yesterday in a text message, I said, I think push-ups might be involved in this. I'm going to fail miserably. And then I watched some of your podcast about visualization and how powerful that is. And I texted him back and I said, I'm actually now visualizing a win. I'm going to kick your ass. So we'll see how this goes.
We'll see how this goes.
But I'm going to take the heels off, put some tennis shoes on, and we're gonna get burpeeing.
All awesome. Right. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Mark Divine, thank you so much for tuning in.
Thank you very much.
Thank
it's been
you.
A blast. Hoo-yah.